Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a very successful musician and his wife. Colm Machanomra started busking in Dublin when he was just 16 years old. On the streets he met a very colourful group of people, including Glen Hansard. He eventually joined Glen's band, The Frames, and played with them across the world. More recently he's been concentrating on his own music and his current album is The Hare's Corner. His wife Sheila is a commercial artist and they live in Wexford together with their two sons, Derek and Oisin. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
So what's it like living with a musician, Sheila?
Well, it can be complicated, you know, certainly. Music spills over into our lives. It's an integral part of our family at home.
But there's probably music non-stop going on in your house, is there?
Colm's music is the soundtrack to our lives, really. And if he's not actually playing it somewhere in the house, then the kids are humming it because they've picked it up from hearing it so much.
Do you have to discipline yourself to write music? I mean, you write nearly all your own music, don't you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
So do you treat it like a day job almost? I must sit down and write.
It doesn't really work out that way necessarily. I think the past few years I've been getting more into soundtrack stuff and I find that's a good actual focus where, you know, I think Cole Porter was asked, you know, which came first, Mr. Porter, the lyric or the melody? And he'd just saying the phone call. The fact of having a deadline kind of gets you into the zone and gets you creative, and then you kind of end up being creative and catching other stuff.
What do you mean by catching music?
Well, I suppose as a musician, I don't really have this sense of my music or ownership of it or, you know, even being proud of it. It's more a case of feeling fortunate to catch it, you know? At least at this stage, a few years on, I can kind of recognise the signs of music coming in. You know, where you're grouchy or
never,
or you're distant, or you know, or you just have this kind of sense of this kind of like it's almost like you're kind of anticipating
away with the fairies, maybe
away with the fairies, indeed. So you can end up kind of finding yourself just digging in the garden just to kind of somehow get grounded, and then you can come in, and then it just flows in through.
It probably helps, Sheila, does it, that you yourself, you know, are an artist, a commercial artist, so you understand the way an artist's mind almost works?
Yeah, I certainly do understand a little bit of the creative process, and, you know, I have great respect for anybody who can live that life full time as well and actually manage to, well, to keep a foot in that world and in the real world too, because that's a difficult thing too. You know, it's very easy to, you know, as I was saying, Colm can be really very away with the fairies and find it difficult to remember to eat or, you know, something basic that's going to make him very cranky about the house. But it's one of those kind of ongoing things where you just say, would you just stop and go and eat something. Then go back to it, and then we'd be able to deal with you.
Yeah. Do you miss him when he's away on tour a lot?
We do.
I know, I do. But it's a very normal process for us, really. We, you know, Colm was touring when we first got together. I was actually travelling a lot before, when we first got together. And Colm, I lived in Dublin, he lived in Galway. So it was quite a tenuous relationship for a while. And when we did move in together, it was normal that there was long absences. It was trickier once the kids came along, really, because I was more limited in everything, really. You know, when you've got small children, you are. But when you don't have another parent there in the evenings, things, you know, have to settle down an awful lot once he does go away.
Your dad, though, was in the Merchant Navy, wasn't he? So you were almost used to maybe
That's right.
Being away a lot.
Yeah. It's a cycle of life that was normal in our house growing up too. And we were used to those kind of big farewells and looking forward to him coming home and the phone calls. You know, at least communication is so much easier now, whereas it used to be dad might ring once a week and he wouldn't really have any news because he'd be in some port like Rotterdam and, we've loaded coal or, and that would be the big when dad's on the phone. Yeah, whatever. Poor dad. We wouldn't be too interested. Whereas Colm, at least he can Skype now and he's good at Skyping. He'd be on the phone or Skype pretty much every day. And the kids can connect with them much easier that way too.
Do you get, though, into your own kind of groove and routine so when he does come back?
Very much so. There's a little bit of friction.
Yeah, bumpy transitions.
It's all transitions. It is, because...
And it's funny, even like in the kind of wind-up to kind of going away for any period of time, there's always almost like a kind of like a detaching process or a day of like a couple of days of transition as
You're
well.
You're gone about 2 days before you actually
leave. Yeah, so it's funny. But I suppose we're getting used to it.
And then, you know, Cullum's very used to operating in hotels and having a tour manager and things like that. So there's a little bit of adjustment in that kind of sense. When he comes home and he says, "What's for dinner?" And you say, "There's dinner on the table." Scratching his head going, "I'm not sure I want that today." And you're like, "Well..."
No, where's the menu? It's funny. No, it's more a case of actually that's one of the main things I miss about home. I mean, other than my beautiful wife and my kids, you know, being able to cook, because you know, you're kind of a slave to whatever.
When you're, and that's where the balance happens. Where I always say, well, if you want it, so you cook kind of,
I tend to cook a lot when I get home.
That's good. Where did the music come from, Colin? Tell me about your family.
Well, there's music on both sides, I suppose. My mum is from Leitrim, and she comes from a kind of classical music background. She played the violin, and my granny played the violin, and then my dad is from Castle in Connemara, and his music is Shannos music, so it's all kind of songs. So I suppose we had both kinds of music in the house, all kinds of music, really.
So when you were growing up, at what stage, for instance, did you start to play an instrument?
My older sister Nuala was learning the fiddle, and she must have been about 11, I suppose, and I would have been 7. I was kind of humming all of her pieces or singing all of her pieces as she practiced them. So my mum bought me a fiddle, and then we went to lessons. And then in school and stuff, we would have learned traditional music as well. So,
And then your life changed when you started to busk at 16.
Yeah, I mean, busking was a big kind of, it's kind of stepping out into the world for yourself, really. I was playing in the school band at the time, which were Keela, who are still pretty much a going concern. And myself and the piper from Keela, Owen, used to go in as a pair. We're kind of smart about it, because we realised that, you know, if you go in as a four piece, you have to split the divvy the money four ways, where if you go in as kind of three different two pieces, everybody, it makes more sense, you know. We started busking about 1985 into 86.
Did your parents mind you?
No, they were fine about it.
Until you came home with the Garda van, maybe.
No.
Oh, yeah? Well, tell that me
that story. That was a good bit later, really.
Okay, tell it to me anyway.
Well, it was a case of it was all fine, and until we'd get together, there'd be up to maybe 10 or 15 musicians playing, and inevitably you'd have a crowd around you, and then the shopkeepers would get angry because you're blocking their shop front, and the guards get angry because you're making a target for pickpockets, and... So there was all this kind of tension going on. So they always want to kind of keep you moving. So there was this particular...
Grumpy guard
this particular day. And there was probably a bit of lip from somebody. And the next thing, the van was called. And we all went down to Pier Street. And yeah, that was my first and only arrest experience.
And when did you meet Glenn Hansard?
That would have been about 1987. I suppose the different musicians on the street, you would have kind of, you know, noticed each other from a distance and kind of being, you know, checking each other out. And then
Mick Christopher was there as
Mick and Glenn were kind of an item, a musical item.
A musical item.
They had a flat. I mean, they were kind of
cool.
They were very cool. I mean, Glenn must have been about 17 and he was living out of home and stuff.
When did you join the Frames then, and how did that come about?
The Frames started in 1990, and I suppose I'd left school in 1989, and I was kind of unhappily in college and
studying.
Well, that's a question.
What's
well,
studying?
Technically, I was studying history, archaeology, and Irish. And
why then, technically?
Well, I suppose, you know, I was away with the music as well. The whole academic aspect was great. I just found it, I suppose, having got a taste of the circus in a way. I suppose it was ingrained quite early. Once you have that that sense of real life and just the excitement and adventure, and just as well, I suppose I was coming from suburban Dublin, and you know, meeting the lads from, you know, Finglas and Clondalkin and Ballymun, and it seemed like real life, whereas at school seemed a bit more kind of.
So, did you drop at ECD when you joined the Frames?
Well, I took a year off. Okay. Technically, I just haven't gone back yet. Yeah. So
one day.
Yeah. So that's what happened, yeah. I took a year off and joined the Frames. Glenn had done a demo. His mum had, I think, gone to a bank manager and told him she was building an extension and got some money to do a demo. Then he got signed to Island Records, and he put a band together with his musical friends, I suppose.
And were they great days? initially?
They were great days. Yeah, absolutely. Huge learning curve, you know, because if you're going from being a kind of street musician to being a recording artist, it's a huge, it's just a huge learning curve. So it's you know, incredibly challenging and exciting and great fun, you know.
And of course, he's gone on to greatness with Once and Everything and all of that.
Ah, yeah, sure. He was always great.
Were you aware of the Frames yourself before you even met him?
I was. Myself and Cullum knew each other for probably about 5 years before we started going out. And we would have been in similar circles of friends, you know, I suppose musicians and artists and kind of, you know, flatland around Ranelagh, Rathmines, kind of we all kind of mingled.
Yeah.
So we would have been aware of each other and crossed, our paths would have crossed now and again. But we were both going out with other people long term for a good while before we both found ourselves eventually single and at the same time, and something happened.
Are you musical?
No, I don't play or sing.
She's probably a secret singer, is she?
I don't know.
No.
No, I don't think she is, actually.
But look, the lovely thing about this morning is you're going to play live for us.
Sure.
And you have some other members of a band here. Tell me about it. Tell me about the first piece of music you're going to play, which you wrote yourself.
Yeah, it's a piece called A Study in Scarlet, which is a title from a Sherlock Holmes story. And playing it with me is Catherine Fitzgerald on piano and Colm Quirney on the guitar.
Fantastic. Welcome to you all. Will you go over and play that now and you can tell me about it afterwards? Was gorgeous. Well done to all of you. Come back to where? What was that about? Why did you write something to do with Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah, friend. Well, it was John Carney actually was doing a film, and he asked us to kind of send him any music that we had, and I knew that Scarlett Johansson was going to be in the movie, so you know I didn't have a title for it, so I just first thing that came to mind was Scarlett, and it was A Study in Scarlet, so which I remembered from reading Sherlock Holmes as a kid. Then it's of course the title stuck. So. And I think Scarlett dropped out of the movie as well.
It doesn't matter. The piece is beautiful. So when did you end up being together and living together, Sheila?
Would have been around 1999. We started going out just before Christmas and met his family for the baptism of fire of the Machinomer Christmas dinner, which is our Christmas night party that they always have where they all play music. And it was amazing for me. I'm raised strictly on a diet of pop and disco on the radio, you know, so it was a whole incredible culture to be
part of,
and to discover, which I hadn't really come across. And even the Irish speaking world, I hadn't even come across before. So it was wonderful.
Were you brought up speaking Irish? Or?
Yeah, it's my first language. Yeah, my dad's from Castle in Connemara. And actually, my mother was raised speaking Irish as well in County Leitrim, which is a pretty unusual in Clooney New York in Manor Hamilton. Her father was, involved in in Conor na Gaeilge when it was starting off and... The language revival, and you know, he was a medical student when the Troubles happened in Dublin in 1918 and stuff. So he raised his kids speaking Irish. So then they got met in Dublin and raised their family speaking Irish.
You, Sheila, do you speak it?
I don't, and the kids are rapidly passing me out, so they're teaching me.
How did you crash course?
Well, Sheila understands everything. It's just the basic
stuff. Once you get into the religion and politics and those kind of things, I'm completely lost.
You were never a white dress kind of woman, is this correct? So how did you end up getting married? You lived together at first for a good while, didn't you?
Yeah, for a good long while. And I was never a marriage kind of girl. I never saw the need even, you know. And I'm sure my friends from college and just after around that time would probably had a good laugh when they heard or when they got the invitations. She was getting married. She said she'd never get married. But it just became something that made sense when we children, I think. I think it was when Derek was very little that was kind of a decision that we came to rather than a big fanfare proposal or anything.
Yeah, by the time we got married, we had, you know, a house, two kids, a pony and chickens. So it's a case of like, I wouldn't have pictured my wedding day or, you know, had any thoughts of it really. but it just made sense. I mean, even the whole idea of kind of referring to somebody as your significant other, or I mean, even the word fiance is so kind of like frivolous or something when you're talking about the mother of your children. So it seemed like sensible and seemed like the right thing to do.
And was it a great occasion?
My sister Nuala had cancer, and we realised that it would be great to just kind of just have an occasion. Nuala, she'd had, I suppose she was sick for about 5 years with remissions and then more chemo and stuff. She totally just saved up all her energy for the wedding and put the glad rags on. And we had just a great day, and she was just the life and soul of the party. And she was like on the bouncing castle with her daughter Isolt on the wedding day. And
I mean, the thoughts of Nuala missing a party.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's unheard of. She was always the centre of, you know.
But it means you also have all the photographs.
We do.
Yeah. I think
we
that's
do.
Lovely.
That's great.
We have beautiful photographs from outside the church beforehand as well, with her, with our children, and with just so many friends. And yeah. It's lovely to have.
Yeah.
And as someone who didn't want to get married, do you think it's a good thing?
Well, it's taken a while to get used to the husband word, but it's...
Not to mention wife, yeah.
Yeah, that too. I expected of marriage that maybe you'd work out your relationship a little bit less after you're married, because you maybe would take a little bit more for granted. But I think I found it the other way around, that you have made this commitment, yeah. And if you're going to be in a relationship and you're, you know, really planning to do it for life, you better not let anything fester, and you better kind of deal with any issues that come up and...
Shape up or ship out.
Yeah, well, you're less likely to ship out, so you better actually try and make it good.
I just think it's just getting rid of anything that's vague in your life, really.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, it's confirmation, really.
Yeah. You have two beautiful boys, but your eldest boy has a difficulty, hasn't he, in his life?
That's right. He has Fragile X syndrome and autism, so he has a dual diagnosis, as they say. He was diagnosed at about 2.5 with Fragile X syndrome, which is the most known genetic cause of autism. They're trying to discover why children have autism and autistic behaviours, but Fragile X is a genetic cause of it, an inherited cause.
But when he was born, I bet you, did he seem a very happy baby? Were you worried about him at the beginning at all?
Not at all. He was a strapping 10-pound one-ouncer and, you know, fed and everything great for about 6 months or so. He did start to have problems with food issues when he started solids around 6 months, where he was really obviously sick. He was diarrhea, and just, you know, went from being a contented sleeping baby to a screaming all night baby. And it was very obvious immediately that there was something wrong there with his digestive system.
And at what stage did you realise it wasn't just a dietary thing?
Probably when he was about a year and a half, he was starting to just kind of slightly fall behind on his milestones, which in itself can be unusual. You know, most children with Fragile X, maybe the muscle tone would show up a little bit earlier, but it took a bit longer with him. And it was very subtle, you know, we didn't really suspect there was anything very wrong at all. But he was just gradually falling a little bit behind. So,
he wouldn't have the initiative, you know.
He never
crawled, and it'd be a case of kind of he'd be pulling himself along on the floor.
Lots of babies do that, but in hindsight, you can look back and say, okay, he could walk at 15 months if you stood him up. He couldn't actually stand himself up, though. You know, so the thought process wasn't really there to figure out the planning stages, the motor planning to get himself to sitting or get himself to standing. And yet he could walk. So there was just that little link missing somewhere. So things like that kind of, you know, that we just thought not much of. And nobody thought much of, really, until we were eventually referred to a psychologist who dropped the bombshell of, your son has serious delays and he's at the expressive language kind of stage of a 6-month-old. And this was when he was about 2. So he referred us then for a panel of tests with the paediatrician. So when he was about 2.5, we got the blood test back to say, this is Fragile X syndrome.
Had you ever heard of Fragile X? And up until then, did you think it was something that just could be fixed?
Yes, for sure. And that was what was quite shocking about Fragile X. Well, two things. Firstly, is that I did know what it was. I had seen a Would You Believe programme about this lovely family who, three of the four adult children had Fragile X. As the parent of a young baby, it was shocking to think that this wasn't going to be a normal trajectory from here. And then the shock as well, of course, as you say, it's not something we can fix. It's genetic.
That moment, I suppose, when you are told that your child has a condition that can't be fixed. I've spoken to so many people about those moments, but were you both there, and did you know what it was, and did you not really know?
Well, I think it was it was messy and less than ideal because Sheila was actually in hospital with our youngest, Oisin, and the diagnosis was kind of dropped from a height, really, and rather than there being any sort of anticipation about it, and I was either away or at home. I can't remember.
I think you were at home with Zarek,
yeah,
and I had been probably 3 days and three nights in hospital with Oisin with just chest infection or a virus, yeah, kind of a thing. But just as the paediatrician was discharging him and saying, you're free to go home, she said, oh, by the way, your other son's results are back in. He's got Fragile X. And that was it. It was brutal, brutal.
Just
you know,
like
I was shattered. I was a shadow of myself already after three nights in hospital. And that was it. And the nurse went off and photocopied me some kind of a leaflet. And the paediatrician told me to look it up on the internet. And that was our support and counselling.
Did you go home and tell Cullum or did you ring him? Or
I think I rang immediately. I completely fell to pieces, completely.
I'm not
because,
surprised.
And I'm usually quite level-headed, I think.
Yeah.
But I just, because I was in such a fragile state already myself, having been in with worried, yeah, about a sick baby. He was only 11 months, Oisin, so he was a very sick baby for a few days. Then to be told that and to know or to have an idea of what the future maybe as an adult might be, having seen the programme, but nothing, knowing nothing about the stages in between, just thinking, well, that's our future. And it just wipes out all your expectations that you don't realise you have either for your child. You don't realise that. You presume your child will be able to work. You presume they'll be independent. You presume they'll walk and talk and be toilet trained. And even such simple things like that, you suddenly have no idea if they'll actually ever be out of nappies. Will they be adults in nappies? And that kind of thought is really shocking, to have to deal with that kind of thing in your future.
Mm.
So how did you react when she told you?
I think, you know, the same. I think there's... It's just like a wrecking ball. And I think it's a kind of... It's just that your life just... got way more interesting very suddenly, and it's just a huge learning curve again. So, and a process really, because I think it's taken me probably a decade to process really, and it's just it's a classic voyage of getting to from denial. It's a grief process, I suppose. You're actually grieving for the assumptions you made about your child. And also then you get to the point in the realisation that you're actually, you know, while it's a really valuable and important process, that you really need to be present for your family. So it's kind of a case of, well, you look, there's no point in me being fallen to pieces and being useless. And so I think we just got stuck in, really.
Mm-hmm. Did you react differently?
I suppose I would have an optimistic disposition.
You probably went and wrote some music.
Well, indeed. But I think from, I'm pretty philosophical at the best of times. So I think I it's not like my son was any different. So the son, you know, I'd held in my arms the day he was born. So, you know, it was a case of, it was just stuff that we were getting empowered potentially in how we could best negotiate the world for him, you know. So I think that's what it is.
And I can see watching you this morning what a close couple you are. It's funny, from my vantage point you can see that. But having a child with a difficulty or a special need can put huge strains in a relationship. Did it at first?
For sure, yeah. And you know, you throw into that mix that Cullum's travelling and coming and going all the time, and he's having to live half his life in this world of whirlwind of gigs and hotels, and you know, that's, you know, huge pressure in itself. And then coming home to me, kind of, you know, scrabbling through the internet looking for how to help and what to do, and nutritionists and, you know, speech therapists, and kind of going, we have to do something, we have to help them,
you know. Not to mention, like, having to access services. I mean, the most difficult part really, I think, was actually you're in a kind of pretty devastated state, and I suppose you're expecting or hoping for some support from the health service, and instead it's completely adversarial. At no point, certainly when we were started our journey, it was a case of, like, they weren't going to tell you what you were entitled to. It was more a case of you having to, if it wasn't for the internet and forums that you could, families could pool their information,
parents,
you know. So it was all about that way, so they'd be very miserly with what they'd tell you and what your entitlements were. And things have changed possibly since, but there was a waiting list for a diagnosis, and then services were withheld until you had a diagnosis. were it not for the fact that we had the resources and the wherewithal to kind of go and go privately and get a diagnosis, we could have been, you know, another 2 years might have gone by. Like, early intervention, it's kind of a cliche, but it's a golden window for the for the kids when their brain is still growing, that you're going to maximise the structures for them, you know.
It's quite demoralising, really, you know, and I spend a good portion of time really ringing people, writing. I write a lot of letters because I'm probably better in writing than I am on the phone or in person, really. It's very, 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 very hard because you do, in a way, you have to beg, and you have to bear in mind that the system is under pressure as well. You know, everybody's under pressure financially. They have to try not to go over their budget. The people who are on maternity leave are not replaced. The therapists who are working on the ground with the kids are fantastic, but they have way too many on their caseload, and your child is just another folder on their desk. And if you're not in touch with them, and if you're not chasing them up, then they'll stay, you know, possibly at the bottom of the folder while somebody else's child makes it up the pile. You know, maybe it's not fair to say, but I think it's probably quite likely in some ways. And certainly, you know, most parents, I think, would agree in that you have to hound people. You know, and there's a policy of, there are things like domiciliary care allowance. There seems to be a policy of immediate refusal, and then you have to appeal it. And it takes months to get to the refusal, and then more months to get to the appeal. And the whole process is just very, very difficult.
Like, for your parents, hands weren't full to start with.
Yeah, for parents that are already, you know, really trying their best to figure out what to do with this child that doesn't follow any of the, you know, kids don't come with the manual anyway, but when you have a child with special needs, you really are under a bit more pressure to try and figure out how to raise them properly and what they need.
People often say the importance of respite, in other words, that you get a break. Do you sometimes envy that because of Colm's work, he gets away a lot, whilst I suppose you don't?
Sure, sure. You know, and obviously his world is a little bit more glamorous and fun sometimes. But I also have travelled, and I also have travelled with the band before with kids, and I know that it's not all fun, and there is an awful lot of hanging around airports, and there's an awful lot of late nights and, you know, 2 hour sleeps before you have to get up and get the next flight and that side of it too.
We had a good trip in 2011 where I went over to Sydney. I got invited over to the Sydney Festival, and it was after Nuala had died, and myself and Sheila went out together and brought my parents as well. And that was a great kind of trip and a good catch up, you know.
It was, yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah.
But it's probably Sheila's first time away from the children since they were born.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was just freedom, you know, complete freedom and independence as a person, you know, not kind of walking around with somebody, you know, any mum knows that somebody needs something from you all the time. And just to be part of it as well was lovely, to feel like a person as opposed to a mum, really. And it was great. And I missed them an awful lot when I was there, but not as much as I thought I would. And coming back was probably tricky in a way. And, you know, I was delighted to be back with them. I really was. But yet, slipping, you know, letting that all go again and slipping back into the, all right, time to ring the speech therapist, time to, you know, make those meetings happen and, you know, try and keep up and all that.
And how is Derek now?
Yeah, he's fantastic. He's made huge progress. We're really, really fortunate in the school we have. So Henry Goff has really created something very special there, and the experts we brought over from the States last year were very clear that St. Enns is not just a school that should be held up within Ireland as the kind of standard of school that we should be aiming for, but internationally. So we are incredibly fortunate in the amount of work they put into the kids there, and he's thriving. You know, they're working as well as they can to get him working well. And Oisin goes there too because it's a mainstream school, and that's lovely as well.
Yeah. How old is Derek?
Derek's 9 and Oisin's just turned 8. It's a year and a half between them.
From a very young age, he's kind of assumed the older brother role. And so the level of emotional intelligence and sensitivity from a very young age, just being able to soothe his brother when he's upset, or, you know, the whole thing with Fragile X syndrome, it's kind of, it's mostly about anxiety. So they thrive in routine structure. So if there's any shake up to that, it's really that, you know, they start to go into a fight or flight kind of state. So for all of us as a family, we've had to kind of tune into that sensitivity that Derek has and basically be as calm as we need to be for him to be calm and safe.
You have this beautiful dog talking about that with you today, which is actually your feet,
yeah,
Sheila.
Cassie is the new addition to our family and the new provider of calm and just pure mellow in our home.
It's a guide dog, isn't it?
She's a guide dog. She's from the Irish Guide Dogs and she's an assistance dog for Darragh, so she's... I think she knows
the listener might hear that. I think she knew we were talking about her, that dog. She's a black Labrador, is she?
She's a Lab Retriever cross and she's only a year and a half old, but the training that goes into them is incredible. So she's already trained to work with Darragh to calm him, but also as a safety measure, he is attached to her by a belt, so he bolts. Fragile X kids, you know, they suffer from hyperarousal, which is that fight or flight thing. So you've only to meet a neighbour in a shop and he's gone. He's in pure panic and he's leaving for somewhere he doesn't know where. He just needs to get away, yeah, and it's panic on his part. But she's trained just not budge.
Isn't that incredible?
Which means that I can, I mean, the relief of stress for me is amazing. Walking down the street with her and there's a, you know, roadworks going on and there's teachers kind of popping out from places and there's just such a stressful environment for me normally and I know he can't run. It's amazing.
Yeah. And does Darragh love the dog?
Oh, it's unbelievable, yeah. And the dog completely acts as a bridge between him and anybody he meets. So Darragh's more likely now, he can kind of completely divert attention to Cassie, the dog, and kind of say... So he's actually getting really verbal with strangers, which is unheard of. And he's kind of saying, introducing, oh, hi, everybody. Have you met my dog, Cassie? She's my, you know. And so it's wonderful. It's really magical to see.
Well, let's take another piece of music. What's the second piece?
This is a tune I got from a box player called Bernie Fudge, a friend of ours in West Kerry. And it's called, well, it's Fáinne Gael an Leigh, which everybody will know. But it's actually an older version, possibly an original version. And followed by a reel that I wrote called Tip the Can.
And the actual instrument you're playing, is it a mix of a violin and a viola? It's a five-string violin?
Yeah, it's a magical instrument, really. And I've kind of hit my groove since meeting this instrument. It was made in Dublin, where Bloom's Hotel is, in about 1770.
Wow.
And it used to have 10 strings, and it was called a cither viol or a sultana. And then it got modified to being a five-string viola about 1900. And when I found it, it had two strings on it and it hadn't been played for 60 years. So it was total dream stuff.
Where did you find it?
A friend of mine, Connor Russell, he's a violin maker, a luthier, and it used to belong to a fellow he worked with, Willie Hoffman, who is a grand old gentleman of the classical music world. And it belonged to Willie Hoffman's father.
Wow.
And it was presented to him as a curiosity, I think, at the turn of the century.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. We'll go over and play it now.
Sure.
Fáinne Gael an Leigh. And I think Frank Tate's going to accompany you on bouzouki. It sounds so familiar, that piece of music, but of course you've mixed it with your own reel and everything. It's beautiful.
Nice one, thanks.
Yeah, no, really nice. God, you're very creative, Colin. We were talking before the break, I suppose, about the fact that your son who's 10 has Fragile X syndrome. Does it make you constantly think about the future or
it
not?
It does, yeah. Well, in a way, you spend half of your time kind of worrying about the future and the other half really trying not to think about it and to just dwell in today because, you know, today is usually... You know, if you can live in the moment, you can get by, obviously, even no matter what your situation is. And the future is very uncertain because we're not sure, even after he finishes in the lovely school he's in now, with, you know, St. Enan's, who I should say actually the new principal is Una Rackart.
Yeah.
When he's finished there, he'll probably go to the special school. After that, I don't know what there is. He's not likely really to live independently. It would be great if he can live with us, but at the same time, we have an obligation or a responsibility to him for his future to kind of gradually ease him into some kind of respite and time away from us too, because we won't always be there.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a temptation to keep him close and look after him because nobody looks after your own like you will.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we can't always be there for him. And, you know, if something was to, God forbid, happen to us, it would be harder on him to have never been to respite or to have never been in any kind of centre, even by daytime.
It's tricky now, having moved away from Dublin, I suppose. But we've, you know, I suppose we've great neighbours and friends around us
we
as
do.
Well.
We're very lucky with our where we've moved to. We have fantastic neighbours. You know, Anne and Seamus on the farm next door have the lads today while we're here. And it's great to have people like that that you can call on. And, you know, Claire Cullum's manager lives quite near us as well. And she's an old friend as well.
Which is great. Yeah. Do you worry about her when you're away? Like, do you worry about leaving her?
Honestly, probably not, because she's so brilliant.
She's so competent.
Do you know, so I don't worry. It's more of a kind of like, it's just actually just really missing them, honestly. You know, so it's, you know, I remember actually after the first time after we had Dara, actually going on the road and having to leave that, you know, when you're the baby moon thing. And just actually having that kind of tearing sensation.
He was only 3 weeks old as
well.
Yeah, he was so
shocking,
little.
Yeah. So that was, it's definitely tough. But I suppose the kids are really used to it. And I'm used to it. And I suppose that it's all about being completely present as much as possible when you're home. You know?
Yeah, there's no lying in and taking it easy when it gets
back.
There's no jet lag.
You're not allowed it.
I'm hungry now.
I've done it for 3 weeks. You get up now.
Well, 3 weeks is a kind of threshold of, you know, it's kind of, you know, anything over 3 weeks, you just kind of lose perspective and it just becomes a real...
you lose touch.
Existential.
Really. 3 weeks is fine because he's kind of, the first week he's just left, then there's a middle week and then he's coming home the next week. So that's okay. After that, it does get long.
Yeah, but we've like, historically, we would have done kind of 6-7 week tours before and that's just kind of completely grueling.
And it's single parented at home.
Good time,
You mentioned existential there. Are either of you religious?
I would say spiritual, not hugely religious. But I have to say, Oisín made his confession and it was lovely. I was surprised at how lovely it was. The church attached to this or near the school, I think it was down to the priest really that was there as well. But when I think of confession, and Darek made his the year before in his communion, but for Darek it was really just a case of if he walks up there and goes near the priest, we're delighted. It's it. He's done it. Great.
Result.
Celebrate.
And
it's a home party. He did it. It was amazing. But again, the SNA and the school would have prepared him every day for weeks and weeks, been trained him to just do this little thing and, you know, the little steps were put in. But with Oisín, the whole thing was all about love. He was told his family loves him, the priest loves him, God loves him, and his penance was to bring that love home to his family. And I couldn't fault it. You know, it was lovely. It was really beautiful and it gave me hope.
Do you pray at all?
Not in such a structured way. No.
Yeah.
No.
Because you often hear about people, and maybe it's older generations, they'd often pray or ask. But you didn't get any sustenance from religion.
No, and Cullum is probably quite religious in a less conventional sense.
Are you Cullum?
Whereas I'm
Well,
not.
No, I think I'm just have this. I was kind of sick. Age 20, I was kind of had, was in hospital and stuff with collapsed lung. And I suppose I had an epiphany then of the difference between the car and the driver, if you want of a better terminology. So just an awareness of the difference between the body and the spirit. So I think my point of view, I would believe that we are spiritual beings having a human experience rather than this being it. So in that regard, I suppose it's a comfort and, you know, it helps to be able to process, you know, the world around you, I suppose. And I love Leonard Cohen. I remember seeing him being interviewed and he said this cool thing about the way the world is and, you know, meeting people. And he described everybody as just being caught up in the flood and everybody's holding onto a little piece of orange crate to stay afloat.
Yeah.
And I thought it's so true, you know, and it's just everybody from the top down, you know, are just doing their best and paddling furiously to stay afloat. Yeah, so
that's so true.
Yeah.
But you, whatever way you're both paddling, it's working very well for you anyway, because it's been lovely having you this morning. We're going to end in a piece of music, Thou Shalt Not Carry Timber.
Yeah.
Now, what is that about?
It's very enigmatic. it's actually in tribute to Sheila's dad, Jim McNally. Because he made a cribbage board. So Sheila, one of like Sheila's kind of heirlooms is a cribbage board, a handmade cribbage board. And cribbage is a kind of a card game, I believe. And it's a kind of a scoreboard that they used to stick matches in to kind of mark your passage around the board. And at the bottom, a bit like kind of, I would imagine, you know, go to jail or pass go on a Monopoly board, there's thou shalt not carry timber. And I thought the phrase was just so cool or evocative or something. Oh. So.
Well, look, it's been my real pleasure having you both here today. Best of luck with all your musical ventures. Make sure you get away a lot as well too, Sheila, okay? And the very best of luck with Oisin and Derek, both of your sons. My thanks on sound today to Sarah May Leach, to my producer Eileen Heron. Thank you all very much for listening. I want to thank the musicians with you today and thank you for playing live, Colm. It's a real
pleasure.
Privilege. Catherine Fitzgerald from Cork, Colm Quirney from Dublin, and Frank Tate from Belfast. Thank you all very much. We'll go out listening now to, what's the name of it again?
Thou Shalt Not Carry Timber.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.